Hi, I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. So far in this series, we've looked at how comparative historical grammar emerged as a university discipline. In this episode, we turn to another side of this tradition, language classification. Throughout the first half of the 19th century, there was a widespread belief that different families of languages are of fundamentally different kinds. These differences were supposedly manifested in the grammatical structures of languages. Received opinion in linguistics today is in stark contrast to this view. Present-day linguists usually observe a clear distinction between genealogy and typology. Genealogical relationships are postulated solely on the basis of reconstructed forms, while similarities in the overall grammatical organization of languages are believed to have no direct bearing on possible common descent. But up into the first half of the 19th century, the present-day separation of genealogy and typology didn't exist. If we turn to Adelung, whose pre-Boppian comparativism we discussed briefly in the first episode, we see that he arranged his survey of languages by geographical region, and then by categories of grammatical structure. Friedrich Schlegel, the inspiration to Bopp, devoted a chapter of his Über die Sprache und Weisheit der Indier to what he called the inner structure of Sanskrit and the European languages. He believed that the Indo-European languages had an organic grammatical structure, and that this distinguished them from all other languages of the world, which were merely mechanical. To try to grasp what Schlegel had in mind, we should turn to the elaboration of his organic-mechanical dichotomy that was made by his brother August Wilhelm Schlegel. As we'll recall from the previous episode, August Wilhelm Schlegel was himself an accomplished Sanskritist and the first professor of Sanskrit and Oriental languages in Germany. August Wilhelm Schlegel developed a scheme of language typology with three primary categories. This scheme persists to this day in a generic form, where the three categories are usually called isolating, agglutinative, and inflectional. The prototypical example of an isolating language is classical Chinese, in which there's almost no morphology. That's to say, in classical Chinese, every word usually has a single form that never changes. To convey grammatical relationships between words, syntax and particles are used. Syntax is essentially the order of words in the sentence, and particles are special grammatical function words. Agglutinative languages are languages like Turkish. In addition to the syntax and particles of an isolating language like Chinese, they also make use of largely invariant affixes that attach to word roots. Finally, inflectional languages, whose greatest exponents are the classical Indo-European idioms, are distinguished by the presence of highly irregular inflections that are intimately bound to roots. In these languages, there's no clear separation between root and inflection, as there is between root and affix in the agglutinative languages. A consequence of the extensive use of inflection is that syntax and other grammatical devices are much less important to the propositional meaning of sentences. The words in a sentence in Latin, for example, can be jumbled around without changing the core statement that's being made. Differences in word order are then used to convey emphasis or other rhetorical features. If we compare the modern European languages to their classical ancestors, we can see that they've lost much of their inflectional character. Modern French, Spanish, or Italian, for instance, make much less use of inflection than Latin, and rely much more on word order. This development led August Wilhelm Schlegel to divide the inflectional class of languages into the older synthetic languages and the younger analytic languages. Friedrich Schlegel's distinction between organic and mechanical languages is essentially targeting inflection. The classical Indo-European languages are organic because he imagines the inflections growing out of the productive germ of the word root, as he put it. Other languages merely stick roots and affixes together in a mechanical way, or, even worse, arrange bare roots into sentences. There's a clear value judgment in this distinction. As a romantic who praised nature over human invention, Friedrich Schlegel believed in the superiority of all that is natural and organic over the functional, human-made and mechanical. For the budding comparative grammarian, there's also a practical advantage to inflection. It's of course the analysis of the shared convolutions and irregularities in the inflectional forms of the Indo-European languages that delivers the proof of their relatedness. The mechanical languages offer much less evidence of this kind to work with. Friedrich Schlegel commented himself that the roots of the mechanical languages present us with no living productive germ, but seem like an agglomeration of atoms, easily dispersed and scattered by every casual breath. August Wilhelm Schlegel, while more circumspect than his brother in this regard, still indulged in value judgments about the different grammatical types. He assigned the inflectional languages to the top rank and believed that isolating languages present great obstacles to the development of intellectual faculties. But he still believed that the modern analytic languages, despite moving away from the inflectional ideal, are capable of refinement. The value judgments offered by the Schlegel brothers were widely shared in this period. When it came to elaborating theories accounting for the structure of the world's languages, the preferred mode of explanation was to link linguistic structures to the thinking of speakers. One of the leading figures in this connection, who inspired numerous scholars in the 19th century and beyond, is Wilhelm von Humboldt. We already encountered Humboldt in the previous episode for his role in the Prussian education reform and the founding of the University of Berlin, which quickly became the center of gravity in the German academic world. But Humboldt was himself a leading language scholar, as well as a theorist of historiography. In his scholarship, he combined elements of contemporary German philosophy of language with empirical results of language research to arrive at key insights into language typology. The link between language structure and thought that Humboldt made is essentially a consequence of what Humboldt scholar Jürgen Trabant calls Humboldt's anti-semiotics. To understand what this means, we need to take a short excursion into the philosophy of language. The semiotic doctrines to which Humboldt's ideas are opposed go back to the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle. In Aristotle's model of signs in language, things in the world cause impressions on the soul. That is, we perceive things in the world and create representations of these in our minds. Spoken words are then meant to be the perceptible external labels that we put on these mental representations. Finally, written words are the graphic representation of spoken words. This model was transmitted and amplified through antiquity, the Middle Ages, and became part of the background to discussions of philosophy of language in the Renaissance and Enlightenment. Enlightenment-era thinking about language, the mind, and our sources of knowledge is traditionally divided into two broad camps, the empiricists and the rationalists. We briefly met representatives of these two camps in the first episode when we talked about Locke, a leading empiricist, and Leibniz, who is usually counted among the rationalists. Empiricism was popular among English and French thinkers and held that the mind is essentially a tabula rasa, or blank slate. On this view, it's our sense impressions that cause us to form ideas, and then we attach words to these ideas in an arbitrary way. The characteristically German position, by contrast, was to say that there's some sort of natural connection between words and ideas. It was this thought that led Leibniz to suggest pursuing etymological research to trace words back to their original natural sources. Two major continuers of this debate after Locke and Leibniz were, on the French side, Étienne Bonnot de Condillac, and, on the German side, Johann Gottfried von Herder. Condillac developed what's referred to as a sensationist account of the origin of language. In his 1746 Essay on the Origin of Human Knowledge, which was conceived as a response to Locke's Essay on Human Understanding, Condillac imagined that there are three kinds of sign: accidental, natural, and instituted. Accidental signs are simply those that frequently co-occur with events in the world, and which we come to associate with those events. For example, smoke is a sign of fire. Natural signs are the cries that we make instinctively, such as the oohs and ahs that we involuntarily produce when we have feelings. Opposed to these first two categories are instituted signs, which are arbitrary. We consciously decide to associate an instituted sign with some particular thing. In a thought experiment later in his essay, Condillac imagines a boy and a girl set out in the world on their own. He hypothesizes that they'll quickly come to invent language themselves. That is, they'll come to invent instituted signs. They'll make natural signs purely by instinct. But their inherent empathy for one another will lead them, after repeated occurrences of these natural signs, to gradually associate the signs with the accompanying sensations. Over time, they'll come to invoke and manipulate the signs consciously, leading to the institution of arbitrary human language. Herder had a different view. In his 1772 Treatise on the Origin of Language, he argued that the transition from natural signs to arbitrary language is not a gradual process, but represents a difference in kind. It's the human ability for reflection that is the qualitative difference that separates humans from animals and makes language possible. Reflection, in Herder's sense, is essentially consciously recognizing one's thoughts. He offers the example of a human being coming to recognize a lamb. The human encounters the lamb on several occasions and receives various sense impressions from it. White, soft, woolly. But one of these impressions will stick out and become the marker on which the human fixates in developing their notion of lamb. The most salient characteristic might be the lamb's bleating. In the moment of recognition, when the concept of lamb precipitates in the human's mind, they'll exclaim, "Aha! You're the bleating one!" In coining their words, different peoples will have focused on different properties of the things named. This means that each language, with its characteristic forms, will encapsulate a slightly different perspective on the world. As languages are passed on from generation to generation, the differences between them will accumulate, making the languages and the worldviews they contain more and more distinct. Humboldt developed his anti-semiotics in the midst of these debates about knowledge, reason, and the origin of language. He formulated his ideas in a number of places, but his most notable text is the long, wide-ranging introduction he wrote to a book on the Kavi language, the idiom in which many sacred texts were written on the island of Java. Here Humboldt described language as the forming organ of thought. In opposition to the traditional Aristotelian model of semiotics, and in line with the German position that we saw represented in Herder's writings, Humboldt argued that it's through the process of articulating our thoughts in words that we synthesize our experiences of the world with our understanding. In putting forward this formulation, Humboldt is drawing on the epistemology, or theory of knowledge, of the great German philosopher Immanuel Kant. In his Critique of Pure Reason, which he published in two versions in the 1780s, Kant famously tried to reconcile the extreme ends of empiricism and rationalism. Kant resisted the extreme empiricist claim that our mind is a tabula rasa and everything we know is determined by sense impressions alone. But at the same time, he objected to the attempts of the most radical rationalists to discount the outside world and derive all of our knowledge from the workings of our internal cognitive faculties. Kant proposed that there is a real world out there, and that we receive sense impressions from it, but that we cannot know it directly. Rather, our understanding plays an active role in perceiving it. Through our faculty of sensibility, we receive sense impressions from the outside world, but we then reconstruct these impressions to build our picture of the world using innate categories that we have in our faculty of understanding. In Humboldt's adaptation of Kant's philosophy, language is the transcendental medium on which we make this reconstruction. That is, it's in language that the Kantian synthesis of perceptual experience with our internal understanding takes place. Humboldt outlined a program for applying this philosophy to the concrete study of languages. He divided his project into two dimensions, one that's concerned with the organism or construction of languages, and another that focuses on the development of their character. The linguistics of construction looks in practice at grammatical features. The assumption is that these features emerged in a putative prehistoric period in which the construction or organism of languages developed in a largely unconscious way. The linguistics of character, by contrast, looks at the use made of a language to create literature. This happens after the language has developed a solidified form. So the goal of the linguistics of character is to study how the means provided by the organism of a language are put to use by its most eloquent speakers and writers. Humboldt described the linguistics of character as the keystone of language study. He didn't believe in a linguistics that was concerned only with the sterile study of grammar. Grammar, he said, is merely the dead skeleton of language. The best way to see the flowering of a language is to study its character through its literature. But 19th century linguists were most receptive to Humboldt's ideas about studying the construction of languages. And Humboldt did go into detail about the linguistics of construction. In line with his view that language is the medium in which the Kantian synthesis of perceptual experience and our internal understanding takes place, Humboldt saw a word in language as the combination of the physically perceptible sound with a concept. It's only through the combination of these two sides that each takes on a definite form. Humboldt's linguistics of construction looks at the different grammatical processes through which this synthesis takes place. Here Humboldt more or less followed and elaborated on the classificatory scheme that came from August Wilhelm Schlegel. According to Humboldt, and in line with aesthetic judgments generally in this period, the most sophisticated grammatical process is inflection. The inflected word combines the concept and its relation to the rest of the proposition, expressed by the root and the inflectional ending respectively, into a single package where the concept retains its individual identity. This is in contrast to isolating and agglutinative structures, where the relation is only in loose association to the concept, or not expressed at all. Humboldt added another grammatical process to this scheme, which he called incorporation. This process is used in many American languages, in particular Nahuatl, which Humboldt referred to as the Mexican language. In this kind of structure, a single word can reach a level of complexity in which it contains all parts of a sentence. Humboldt believed that this kind of structure is inferior to inflection because the separate concepts expressed in the sentence are all mashed together into a single form. We should note that Humboldt's discussion is not actually about different language types, but rather about grammatical processes which can cut across languages. No language represents a single type completely, although every language may have a predominating type. Nevertheless, the preferred mode of the leading linguists in the 19th century was to identify an essentialist type for each language and classify languages according to it. For most of these linguists, Humboldt's theorizing and its philosophical background was the point of departure and touchstone for their own typological work. We'll look at these developments in 19th century typology in the coming episodes. But first, in the next episode, we'll learn more about Humboldt and his contributions to language study when we talk to the Humboldt expert, Jürgen Trabant.